we cannot ignore the elephant in the room, and that is that President Trump has launched an all-out assault on the independence of the Federal Reserve.
One of President Trump's picks for the Federal Reserve's governing board was grilled on Capitol Hill today.
It's Thursday, September 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, whether you can get a COVID vaccine this fall may depend on where you live.
How states are setting up different policies.
We're seeing something happen that we're concerned, and we're not going to wait to see how it plays out.
Also, the video game Hollow Knight Silksong is finally here after a year's long wait.
Tons of players crashed online storefronts to snag their copies.
And our colleagues from NPR's science podcast, Shortwave, bring us some very practical advice.
I think in one sentence, it's don't bring your smartphone into the bathroom.
Those stories and more coming up after the summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. tangled with senators from both parties on Capitol Hill today over his changes to COVID-19 vaccines and personnel issues. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
The Senate Finance Committee's grilling of Kennedy was full of rancor, including from his own party. Louisiana Republican and physician Bill Cassidy accused Kennedy of going back on a specific promise not to undermine Americans' access to vaccines. Now, Cassidy says Kennedy is going against science, quote, effectively denying people vaccine, end quote, by removing the recommendation for COVID-19 vaccines for healthy children and pregnant women.
It also surprises me because you've canceled, or HHS did, but apparently under your direction, $500 million in contracts using the mRNA vaccine platform that was critical to Operation Warp Speed.
Kennedy at times got agitated at the hearing, arguing he is defending a gold standard of science. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Federal investigators seized cell phones, computers, and documents in their search of the home of former Trump advisor turned critic John Bolton. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports that's according to court documents filed today by the Justice Department.
Federal agents conducted a search of John Bolton's Maryland home late last month. Now the Justice Department has filed in federal court a redacted version of the search warrant and other documents in response to a request from media organizations, including NPR. The DOJ filing indicates that Bolton is under investigation for possibly gathering, transmitting, or losing defense information and the potential unauthorized removal and retention of classified documents. A redacted copy of the inventory from the Bolton search shows that agents seized cell phones, hard drives, and computers, as well as typed documents and a binder labeled Statements and Reflections to Allied Strikes. Bolton served as Trump's national security advisor before becoming a fierce Trump critic. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the United States is designating two Ecuadorian gangs as foreign terrorist organizations. The two gangs are blamed for much of the violence that has flared since the pandemic started. And Rubio says the U.S. is moving to boost cooperation with Ecuador in taking on those gangs.
This time, we're not just going to hunt for drug dealers or the little fast boats and say, let's try to arrest them. No, the president has said he wants to wage war on these groups because they've been waging war on us for 30 years and no one has responded. But there's no need to do that in many cases with the friendly governments because the friendly governments are going to help us. They may do it themselves.
It's the Trump administration's latest move against the cartels. Rubio is set to meet with Ecuadorian leaders this week. Wall Street higher by the closing bell, the Dow up 350 points. You're listening to NPR News. President Trump is hosting a high-powered list of tech CEOs for a dinner at the White House tonight. Among those on the guest list, Bill Gates, Tim Cook, Mark Zuckerberg, and a dozen other executives from the biggest artificial intelligence and tech firms. But missing from the list, Elon Musk, who had a public breakup with Trump. This is the Trump administration pursues several antitrust cases against big tech, with cases against Meta, Apple, Google, and Amazon seeking to rein in big tech's market power. The NFL season kicks off tonight when last year's Super Bowl champs, the Philadelphia Eagles, host the Dallas Cowboys. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports the Eagles are top contenders for this year's title alongside a trio of teams from the AFC.
The Eagles dominated the Super Bowl last year, so it's no surprise they're the early favorites to win it all again. Their key players have all returned, including quarterback Jalen Hurts and running back Saquon Barkley. The Green Bay Packers are a new favorite after a blockbuster trade with the Cowboys to add superstar defensive end Micah Parsons. In the AFC, the Kansas City Chiefs have reached the Super Bowl 5 of the last 6 years running. The Buffalo Bills and the Baltimore Ravens would like to end that streak. Their quarterbacks, Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson, have both won MVP, but neither has ever played in a Super Bowl, thanks to the Chiefs. In Week 1, the Bills and Ravens will face off against each other with a heavyweight primetime matchup Sunday night in Buffalo. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Kansas City.
On Wall Street, by the closing bell, the Dow was up 350 points, NASDAQ up 209, S&P 500 up 53. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance, from filing returns to tracking assessments. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Grand Rapids Riverfest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Want to volunteer at the event? Head to GrandRapidsRiverFest.com under Get Involved. Weather tonight, showers likely, cloudy with temps in the low 40s, northwest winds gusting up to 25 miles per hour.
Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Senators grilled one of President Trump's nominees for the Federal Reserve Board today. They want to know if he'll be taking orders from the president when it comes to setting interest rates. By law, the Fed is supposed to operate independently of the White House. But Trump has been waging an aggressive campaign to exert more control over the central bank. NPR's Scott Horsley was following the hearing, and he's with us now. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Ari.
Tell us about this nominee.
Stephen Miron is currently a White House economist, and he raised some eyebrows today when he said he plans to keep one foot in that White House job, even if he gets the Fed post. He said he would take an unpaid leave with an eye towards going back to the administration early next year. Nevertheless, Miron told senators if he does find himself sitting in the Fed's boardroom, he would not be taking direction from the president on interest rates.
If I'm confirmed to this role, I will act independently, as the Federal Reserve always does, based on my own personal analysis of economic data and based on my judgment of the best economic policy possible.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren was skeptical. She asked Myron a couple of questions in an effort to test his independence.
Did Donald Trump lose the 2020 presidential election?
Joe Biden was certified by Congress as the president of the United States.
Right. So did Donald Trump lose that election?
As I just said, Joe Biden was certified by Congress.
Did Donald Trump lose that election? Can you say the words, Donald Trump lost that election? Are you independent enough to say that?
As you can hear, Myron ducked that question, along with another one about whether he agreed with the president that government number crunchers have been faking data to make Trump look bad.
Well, explain what is at stake in this nomination.
On the surface, this is just a short-term job. It only lasts about 5 months, filling out the term of Fed Governor Adriana Kugler, who stepped down last month. But Trump is also hoping to create a second opening at the central bank by firing Fed Governor Lisa Cook over allegations of mortgage fraud. Cook, by the way, has denied those allegations, and she's challenging her dismissal in court. But if Trump succeeds in filling both these seats, then a majority of the Fed's 7-member board members would be Trump appointees, and that could mean Trump's constant demands for lower interest rates would get a little more traction at the Fed. Senator Warren, who's the top Democrat on the Senate Banking Committee, says that's the backdrop in which this short-term nomination has to be considered.
We cannot ignore the elephant in the room, and that is that President Trump has launched an all-out assault on the independence of the Federal Reserve.
Now, the reason the Fed is supposed to be independent and insulated from political pressures from the White House is so it can make sometimes unpopular decisions, like keeping interest rates high if that's what's necessary to curb inflation. Of course, Trump has been trying to chip away at that insulation.
How likely is he to get confirmed?
It looks pretty likely. Myron got a friendlier reception from Republicans on the Banking Committee, and of course, the GOP has the majority in the Senate. Louisiana Republican John Kennedy stressed that if Myron does wind up at the central bank, he does need to keep the president at arm's length.
Are you Donald Trump's puppet?
Not at all. I'm very independently minded.
We're going to hold you to that, Governor, future governor. You need to call him like you see him.
So you can hear Kennedy refer to Myron there as a future governor of the Federal Reserve. It looks as if he could be confirmed in time to take part in the Fed's next decision on interest rates, which is coming up in less than 2 weeks, and the Fed is widely expected to lower its benchmark rate by a quarter percentage point.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
Your ability to get a COVID shot this fall may depend on where you live. States are setting up different policies around vaccines in response to concerns over federal leadership. NPR's Ping Huang reports.
Washington State is banding together with its neighbors to create a West Coast Health Alliance. Dennis Worsham, Washington's health secretary, says it's a preemptive move.
We're seeing something happen that we're concerned, and we're not going to wait to see how it plays out.
Those concerns include staff and budget cuts at federal health agencies, the firing of prominent doctors from vaccine advisory committees, and the firing of the new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The tipping point came last week, Worsham says, when the Food and Drug Administration put limits on who's eligible for the fall COVID shot.
We as an alliance will work together to review the data that is being put out in order to make recommendations for the people here in the state of Washington, Oregon, and California.
Dr. Erica Pan is director of the California Department of Public Health.
I'm sad that we are in this place that we have to do this.
But the reason they're doing it, she says, is that vaccines do a great job of keeping people healthy.
Vaccines are one of the most important public health interventions in our lifetimes after sanitation. And they have saved, you know, millions of lives. And we want to make sure we continue to do that.
And the advice from the federal government under Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is starting to diverge from those of professional medical groups.
And we do have concerns that access and or recommendations for safe and effective vaccines could change from the federal level.
The CDC's current vaccine advisory committee has not yet weighed in on who should get COVID vaccines this fall. In New Mexico, the delay has prompted Gina de Blasi, the cabinet secretary for health, to issue a public health order to make the vaccines widely available at pharmacies.
The vaccines are anticipated to be received in the state this month. We just want to make sure that we're ready to go and able to serve New Mexicans.
De Blasi says the demand has been highest for those 65 and up.
But we want to make it available for those that are in high-risk populations or those that are caring for individuals that are in that high-risk group.
Massachusetts, which is leading a public health collaboration in the Northeast, has announced that it's requiring insurers to cover vaccines the state recommends. While states with Democratic governors have been zigging to protect vaccine access, the Republican state of Florida has zagged. Yesterday, at a press conference, Florida Surgeon General Joseph Latipo called COVID vaccines poison and said requiring them echoes slavery.
Who am I as a government or anyone else, or who am I as a man standing here now, to tell you what you should put in your body?
Latipo announced that Florida will be working to end all vaccine mandates in the state. His office did not respond to an interview request from NPR. Dr. Susan Consagra, with the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, says many state laws are tied to what the CDC's advisory committee recommends.
While there's always been some variation state by state in vaccine laws, what we're seeing now is an amplification of that.
Given the confusion and instability on the federal level, some states are looking to other sources for their vaccine recommendations. Consagra says this can be confusing for consumers.
Talk to your provider, get your information from a trusted source around vaccines, and, you know, make sure you understand where to go and your insurance coverage as well as we navigate this changing landscape.
Later this month, state health officials will be watching closely when the CDC's revamped Vaccine Advisory Committee meets to vote on recommendations for COVID, hepatitis B, and some other vaccines. Ping Huang, NPR News.
If you ever wanted to be a bug-like creature swinging a sword, Hollow Knight might be the video game for you. Diehard fans of this 2017 hit have waited years for its sequel, and today hordes of players crashed online storefronts snagging their copies of that sequel called Hollow Knight Silksong. Here's NPR's Kai McNamee.
Gamescom in Cologne, Germany is the world's largest video game convention.
Is it working? Am I live? Hi, everyone.
YouTuber Alan Ferretti Horst was there last month, live streaming from his tent on the convention campgrounds. Online, he goes by the name Blue SR, and he makes videos playing Hollow Knight. In the game, you play a knight exploring a two-dimensional world, hopping between platforms and slashing enemies. Ferretti Horst came to Gamescom for one thing, a playable demo of Hollow Knight's long-awaited sequel, Hollow Knight Silksong.
You should have seen the lines. It was crazy. There were so many people excited about it.
Even better than a demo, during the convention, the creators of the game announced Silksong would be released just 2 weeks later.
It honestly still doesn't feel real. I feel like at any moment I could pinch myself and wake up.
Zach Kazmierski runs a Reddit community dedicated to Hollow Knight. It's one of many online communities where people talk about the game, share fan art, hang out, and they've spent plenty of time waiting for Silksong. Over the years, speculation about Silksong's release whipped fans into bouts of frenzied excitement. Every year at major video game events, they would flock to the live stream and spam the chat with messages like Silksong, when?
It was a little overwhelming, to tell you the truth. People can be a little bit overzealous about this series sometimes.
People kept wondering, is this going to be the Xbox event or the Nintendo Direct where Silksong finally shows up? And as the years went on, the silence just became totally deafening.
That's Bloomberg video game reporter Jason Schreier. The game's creators, Team Cherry, were almost completely silent during the sequel's development, which Schreier says only helped fuel the intrigue and draw more players to the game. Take 2019. That year, Team Cherry announced plans for a sequel, but didn't say when they'd release it. At that point, Hollow Knight had sold around 3 million copies. But as online chatter from expectant fans grew, so did sales. Today, that number is around 15 million copies. Fans of Hollow Knight will tell you its vast world, tight controls, and haunting score make it a perfect game. Riley Johnston breaks down video game design on her YouTube channel, Juniper Dev. She says the hand-drawn art sets Hollow Knight apart.
Every time that I went to like a new space in the map, like the Crystal Peaks, Green Path, Fog Canyon, just discovering all the different sound effects, the enemies, like they build the world so well that like genuinely all you can feel is just awe.
All that awe is the work of a very small crew. Team Cherry is a tiny studio made up of only 3 full-time staff. Jason Schreier says that's really astonishing.
Especially because you have comparative games that are made by thousands of people and don't sell nearly as many copies.
Team Cherry didn't respond to my request for an interview, but they explained to Schreier that the development of Silksong was smooth. They were just quietly working on the game, taking their time with it and not letting the online excitement distract them. Now, 6 years after Team Cherry announced the sequel, fans will finally see if Hollow Knight Silksong lives up to the hype. Kai McNamee, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on member-supported KAXC KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m. Information about this summer's Martini Monday music series is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com.
On today's date, I had a lovely hike in the woods in Balsam Township with a fellow named Al Hupula. And Al was a great woodsman and a wonderful associate. We had many nice walks in the woods. On this day, we came across northern holly, just becoming ripe. They have bright orange berries in the fall, almost tending to scarlet. And those berries are very, very bitter, very foul-tasting berries. They're filled with a chemical called saponin, and that saponin is in there to keep the birds from eating the berries before they're fully ripe. And it delays the consumption of the berries by the birds until late September, early October, when the plant will recover the saponins from the berries, store it in its plant tissues, and use it again next year. But the berries then become palatable to the birds, and white-throated sparrows and robins will hover on these bushes and consume all of those berries before very long into the future. Every bit as good as a finger covered in earwax. Very, very bitter.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. It's time now for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR's science podcast. I am joined by the show's two hosts, Regina Barber and Emily Kwong. Hi, all.
Hi. Hey.
So I know that, like usual, you have brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. Tell us what they are.
New research that tells us more about the inside of Mars and what makes it different from Earth.
And speaking of Earth, we have a new way to recycle plastic.
And why scrolling on the toilet may not be good for you.
I have a lot of questions, but let's start with Mars, the red planet. Emily, why don't you kick us off?
So there are two new studies looking at this using data from NASA's InSight mission, which placed the first seismometer on Mars' surface in 2018. This seismometer collected data about Mars quakes, which is sort of a way of taking an X-ray of the planet. And now this data is giving scientists a glimpse into the planet's history to see how Mars has evolved over billions of years and how its inner structure compares to Earth.
Okay, go on. What is going on inside Mars?
So scientists used to think that the Mars core, the innermost layer, was liquid. But new research in the journal Nature shows that the core has an inner, like, solid core and a liquid outer core.
And that structure is similar to Earth. Our Earth's core has a solid center and liquid outer layer underneath the Earth's mantle.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, the internal structure of Mars might be a little more like Earth according to this new study, but help me understand why this matters.
Yeah, so on Earth, the internal structure helps create a magnetic field, and that protects our atmosphere from the sun's radiation and is part of why our planet is habitable. It's important for life.
Yeah, and while Mars doesn't have a magnetic field, researchers think it did at some point in its history. So this new paper could help scientists figure out when and why the magnetic field faded.
Well, don't leave me hanging. Did they come up with an answer?
Juana
wants to know now.
They still do not know. And that's where the second study out recently in the journal Science comes in. And it looks at another layer of Mars, its mantle, and that sits between its core and its crust.
Now, traditionally, people thought Mars's insides looked like a smooth layer cake. But this paper suggests Mars' mantle is chunky, like Rocky Road ice cream. Only instead of marshmallows and chocolate, it's full of remnants of collisions from the planet's past, when protoplanets and comets and asteroids crashed into Mars.
Okay, you're making me hungry, but I'm going to set that aside for a second. What does that Rocky Road structure mean for the planet?
Yeah, that's a good question. We asked one of the lead researchers, Konstantinos Haralambos. He told us that the fact that these pieces survived over billions of years suggests Mars' mantle traps heat. That slows down the cooling of the planet's core and may be part of the reason why Mars doesn't have a magnetic field.
Taken all together, this new ice cream image and these two papers, they fill out details about Mars, lending new clues about how planets form and what makes them suitable for life.
Right. Interesting. Let's go to the next science story, which is about plastic recycling. And I know that a lot of plastic is used for packaging because I shop too much.
Yeah, so much.
Same.
Every year, the average American discards nearly 500 pounds of plastic. A lot of that gets mixed together when it is tossed. So your milk jugs go in with your yogurt cups and your snack wrappers, and it all contains different plastic chemicals.
So facilities use optical sorters or infrared scanners to sort it all out by type, which is pretty tedious and costly. In fact, less than 10% of plastic gets recycled worldwide.
But scientists at Northwestern, Purdue, and Iowa State universities have figured out a new way to potentially bypass the need for pre-sorting mixed plastic waste. And they published this work in the journal Nature Chemistry this week.
So what's the secret?
It's a nickel-based catalyst that's activated by a special powder. So when mixed with plastic waste that's heated, this catalyst actually breaks down what's known as polyolefin plastics. And polyolefins are important because they make up most of the plastic worldwide.
Sandwich bags, garbage containers, food containers, milk jugs, all of those things.
This is Tobin Marks, the senior author of this paper, and he spent much of his career making plastics.
I obviously was concerned, as I think all citizens are, about these huge amounts of plastic just being dumped in landfills, floating in the ocean.
So he thought, what if I deployed the same technique I used to make plastics, a catalyst, to take plastics apart?
His team's catalyst cuts the carbon-to-carbon bonds, transforming the plastic into oils or waxes or hydrocarbon gas, which can be upcycled into higher-value products.
Like what?
Like lubricants, fuels, and even candlesticks.
But do you think plastic facilities will really start using this catalyst?
That is a question for the industry, right? Troels Skristrup, a chemist at Aarhus University in Denmark, who is not a part of the study, said it's premature to evaluate what this catalytic system could do in the real world. But it's always a plus to present new technologies for solving our plastic problem.
All right, y'all, let's end with this story that I have been waiting for. It's about using a smartphone on the toilet.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, sitting for so long in the toilet while you're looking at, like, too many TikToks was, I mean, we all knew it was never going to be good for us.
For so many reasons.
And a recent study in the journal PLOS ONE says scrolling on your phone while in the bathroom is linked to a higher likelihood of getting hemorrhoids, those sometimes painful swollen veins around your anus or lower rectum, specifically 46%. More likely.
I still have questions. How did researchers even think to study this?
Yeah. Well, Dr. Trisha Pasricha is a neurogastroenterologist who just got curious. She sees a lot of patients who have hemorrhoids or GI issues, and she wanted to know if there was any research on what happens when you sit on the toilet too long looking at your phone.
And to my great surprise, nobody studied this.
So Trisha and her team surveyed and collected medical data from 125 healthy individuals that were getting routine colonoscopies. It's a small study.
But among these patients, they asked all these questions. People's fiber intake, if they've been pregnant, if they get constipated a lot, and if they use smartphones while on the toilet and for how long. And Trisha found that, yes, indeed, scrolling on the toilet was a predictor for hemorrhoids.
So then what's her advice for these folks?
Yeah, that was one of my top questions, and not for personal reasons at all.
Sure.
I think in one sentence, it's don't bring your smartphone into the bathroom.
Impossible.
Yeah. She said, this is really hard to avoid, right? It's so comforting. So if you can't avoid bringing your phone in the bathroom, set a timer. But the advice I loved the best is that she encouraged people to bring back the bathroom library, like comics, you know, Farside, poetry, things that are short and not designed to keep you scrolling, you know, the way social media does.
So in addition to your bed, before you sleep, you can add the bathroom to a growing list of places and times not to doom scroll.
Oh, good. Another excuse to get my phone out of my hand. Love that for me.
Yes.
That's Emily Kwong and Regina Barber from NPR's science podcast, Shortwave. Subscribe now for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
The new horror movie, The Conjuring Last Rites, is out this weekend. It's part of a franchise based on Ed and Lorraine Warren, a controversial real-life couple who claimed to be demonologists. The movie views them as heroes, others not so much.
These are cases where people are in distress, and I don't think it helps to have a couple of people who have no training and no clinical background show up, tell you it's a demon, and walk away with book and movie contracts.
Hear more tomorrow on All Things Considered. Listen on your radio or try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by now. This is NPR News.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has had some wins on his policies to, quote, make America healthy again. Some states have passed laws banning food dyes and requiring labels on ultra-processed foods.
We have been the busiest, most proactive administration in HHS history.
How Kennedy is trying to reshape America's health policy. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 429, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, or buy a ticket to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Visit KAXE.org. Registration is now open for the in September 15th. Learn more and register at itascaorchestra.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A case is ongoing in Wisconsin over a legal challenge to key permits for a project to reroute an oil and gas pipeline around a Lake Superior tribe's reservation. As Danielle Kading reports, Canadian energy firm Enbridge wants to build a new stretch of its Line 5 pipeline.
Enbridge proposed the reroute after the Bad River Tribe sued to shut down the pipeline on tribal lands. Now the tribe and environmental groups are challenging the state's decision to issue a wetland and waterway permit, among other approvals for the project. They say the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources lacked baseline data about the project's effects on wetlands. At the first hearing, Bad River Tribal Chair Robert Blanchard said a potential spill could spell disaster for the tribe's homeland.
It's going to affect our way of life, and that's why we are fighting this so hard.
Enbridge spokesperson Jennifer Smith said they designed the route to minimize harm.
We believe that the Wisconsin DNR's permits are accurate, they're correct. We can build this pipeline with minimal environmental impact.
The reroute would cross nearly 200 waterways and disturb around 100 acres of wetlands. Supporters say it would create 700 jobs, but opponents question the company's environmental track record. A DNR attorney says it properly permitted the project under the law. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
Efforts in New Mexico have been relaunched to find about 150 tribal items stolen in 1984. Earlier this year, a bull stolen from the Santa Ana Pueblo ceremonial village was returned. Monica Morrell, director of the Santa Ana Historic Preservation Department, says that led investigators to look for more leads on other items.
We have right around a dozen objects that we have very close connections.
Items that are at least a century old are considered antiquities and protected under the Archaeological Resources Protection Act. And in 2022, Congress passed legislation prohibiting the export of items held sacred by tribes. Tributes continue to pour in for Canadian Indigenous actor Graham Greene. He died on Monday of natural causes. He was 73. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, for many critics, Green had a groundbreaking career.
Green was an Oneida from the Six Nations Reserve in Ontario. Among those who paid tribute to his work was actor Kevin Costner, who described him as a master at work and a wonderful human being. It was with Costner that Green was nominated for an Academy Award for the film Dances with Wolves. Costner posted one of his favorite scenes from the movie when Green played the part of Kicking Bird, a Sioux medicine man.
Tatanka.
Tatanka.
Dances with Wolves was his big break, and Green wasn't going to look back.
I'll be damned if anybody's going to push me off this heap. You know, I'm going to fight as hard as I can to stay there and get more writers, more actors, more storytellers, more film crews, you know, anybody in the technical end to seriously get on board.
And that followed with several roles in movies and television. The Stratford Festival in Ontario also paid tribute to Green, who played Shylock in the 2007 production of The Merchant of Venice and Lenny in John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. Green was also honored with the Governor General's Performing Arts Award for Lifetime Artistic Achievement. Governor General Mary Simons said he brought dignity to every character he portrayed. She said he broke barriers for Indigenous actors and opened doors for future generations. And we honor his extraordinary contributions, she said, to Canadian culture and celebrate a legacy that will resonate across Canada and beyond. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. For more than a decade, the website climate.gov explained climate science to the public, serving up timely information about hurricanes, wildfires, droughts. The site was run by NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it drew nearly a million visitors a month. Well, earlier this year, the Trump administration began to dismantle climate.gov. It stopped updating the site. It laid off the staff. Now, some of those staffers are regrouping. They are attempting to launch a new site called climate.us. And Rebecca Lindsay is leading the charge. She's the former editor of climate.gov, and she's here now. Rebecca Lindsay, welcome.
Thank you.
So why this new site? Tell me what you're hoping to achieve.
We were just hoping to protect and preserve the information that existed on climate.gov. We want to essentially create a nonprofit successor to climate.gov in a place outside the federal domain where people can trust that the information is not going to be politicized or tampered with.
So nonprofit outside the U.S. government, volunteer run at this point, is that right?
It is.
Okay.
Right now we are strictly doing this as a labor of love. There's a team of about four of us that have been working on it over the summer. We're not sure how long we will be able to go around unemployed, but we are trying to get nonprofit and foundation funding to transition the whole operation from the federal domain to the nonprofit sector.
So I will note, right before we called you, I typed climate.gov into my browser. I was redirected to a climate site run by NOAA. I'm looking at it right now. It does include recent news like the fact that July 2025 was the Earth's third warmest July on record. There's also drought.gov. There's heat.gov. Can't people still get the climate information they are looking for at an official U.S. government website?
For right now, yes, there's some information that can still be found on other government websites. Climate.gov, though, was unique. We were the only website that actively worked to combat misinformation on social media, and we provided a direct link from the science community and the world of scientists to the public.
I am thinking, I'm sitting here talking to you from the NPR newsroom. We have a climate desk. Many news organizations have a climate desk. There are plenty of climate scientists who are able to post directly on social media. Plenty of non-governmental places where people can learn about climate change, in other words. What do you see your site adding to that mix that's not currently out there?
Well, many of those sites that you mentioned, the many of those news desks, actually depend on climate.gov for story ideas. Mm-hmm. We even routinely see our data visualizations and maps used by the mainstream media. The other thing is climate.gov had a complete collection of classroom resources for teachers. So it was really a full service platform for climate information for multiple audiences.
Does being outside the government have any advantages? Does that open any new opportunities for you?
Yes, and that's really one of the things that's most exciting about this initiative. We do have the potential to partner with other organizations in ways that we didn't when we were affiliated with the federal government. It's also possible that we will be able to expand our communications into things like what people can do about climate change. It was something that we were asked for constantly. People would say, can you please add information to your site that is about what we can do about climate change? And we will, of course, now have the freedom to do that.
Rebecca Lindsay, former editor of climate.gov, now spearheading the new site climate.us. Rebecca Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you.
A rigorous new study finds that a single dose of LSD can ease a person's anxiety for months. NPR's John Hamilton reports that the study shows how research on psychedelics is entering the mainstream.
The study involved 198 adults with generalized anxiety disorder, or GAD, which affects about 1 in 10 people over the course of a year. Dr. David Feifel of Kadima Neuropsychiatry Institute in San Diego says GAD can derail a person's life.
It's characterized by continuous worry, inability to relax, and all the physical manifestations, racing heart rates and sweatiness.
And it's often accompanied by depression. Current drugs are inadequate for about half of people diagnosed with GAD, so Feifel agreed to help test an alternative, a proprietary form of the psychedelic compound LSD. He says it's nothing like Prozac or Zoloft.
This is something that has a very, very distinct subjective experience, you know, what people might call a trip.
The drug, known as MM120, comes from MindMed, which funded the study. Participants were randomly assigned to get a placebo or one of four dosage levels of MM120. Lower doses had no significant effect, but Feifel says the two higher doses, which pretty much guaranteed a psychedelic experience, made a big difference.
By the next day, the drug, for all intents and purposes, was out of their system, and yet the patient's average anxiety was greatly reduced.
Feifel says seeing a drug work so quickly was remarkable.
The other remarkable thing about it was those improvements held out all the way to the end of the study, which was 12 weeks.
Higher doses also relieved depression. The results appear in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And Feifel says high-quality studies like this one are giving legitimacy to research on a range of psychedelics, like psilocybin and MDMA.
This is a wave of new generation medications that really would revolutionize treatment in psychiatry.
That's probably true, says Robin Carhart-Harris, a psychedelics researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. But he has mixed feelings about the new study.
The safety looks good, the tolerability looks good, but where's the depth of information about the way you delivered this product?
Carhart-Harris says researchers focused on the drug itself while saying little about other factors that might have influenced the outcome. He says there's strong evidence that patients do better if they are carefully guided through a psychedelic experience and if the experience includes certain types of sensory stimulation, like music.
To not say anything about music listening, for example, when it's been present in virtually 100% of the trials that have been published to date on psychedelic therapy, is an obvious omission.
In the MM120 study, people could request music, but it wasn't specified in the protocol. Carhart-Harris says that's too bad because it's critical to learn how to administer psychedelic drugs now before doctors start prescribing them.
Probably give it a couple of years and we'll be seeing drugs like psilocybin, magic mushrooms as medicines. And yeah, a whole cultural shift and mindset shift is going to happen around that.
MindMed has already launched two larger studies of its LSD drug, one for anxiety, the other for depression. The company expects results sometime next year. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library welcome author Kerry J. Griffith Monday, September 8th at noon. He'll discuss his book, Rattlesnake Bluff, A Sam Rivers Mystery. You may bring your own lunch or enjoy the light refreshments provided. And we receive support from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, serving more than 44,000 members in northern Minnesota. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. Mixed Precipitation Opera and Theater Group presents Pickup Truck Opera Volume 5, Saturday, September 13th at 3 p.m. at the Mask and Rose Theater in Popaski.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
the woman accused of yelling racial slurs at a black child in Rochester will likely face criminal charges. Then, Minnesota attracts athletes from around the globe for an international competition. And a court reverses the conviction of a pipeline protester in northern Minnesota. I'm Chantel Sings. The Rochester City Attorney's Office is filing a complaint summons against the woman accused of yelling racial slurs at a young black child earlier this year. Video of the incident went viral on social media, sparking outrage against as well as support for Shiloh Hendricks, who will now likely face 3 counts of disorderly conduct. The charges carry a sentence of up to 90 days in jail and or a $1,000 fine. A district court judge still has to review and approve the charges. The city attorney says the decision to charge took longer than expected because of the sensitive and complicated nature of the incident. Up next, athletes from all over the world gathered at the Mall of America to compete in the USA Wheelchair Softball World Series. Catherine DeSalle takes us to the tournament.
Best way to picture this game is close your eyes. You are coming up to the plate. It's the bottom of the ninth. You've got a runner on third. It's a tie game. It's you versus the pitcher. At no point did we say that you're in a wheelchair or you're going to have to run or push to first base. It's the same desire. It's the same game. It's that same athletic competitiveness. We just do it a little differently.
That's Jeff Downs, tournament director for the 2025 National Wheelchair Softball World Series. This summer, Minnesota hosted the tournament in the parking lot of the Mall of America with more than 300 athletes competing from states all across the U.S.
We had set up 5 fields in the north parking lot of Mall of America, and we played almost 60 games in 2.5 days, despite the weather and lightning strikes.
Wheelchair softball originated in the Midwest in 1976 and was created by athletes with spinal cord injuries who wanted to enjoy the game. It's very similar to typical softball, except it's played on a hard surface, such as a parking lot. Another big difference is that most players don't wear gloves, so they can easily move their wheelchairs to make plays.
The only people that wear gloves is typically the first baseman to try and snag those balls or coming in at them hot. We use a 16-inch softball. It's a little softer than the standard ball. It's still going to hurt you when you get a line drive shot at you.
Anyone with a physical disability that is in a wheelchair can play. The teams are set up with athletes classified based on their abilities, with a range from 0 to 4.5.
As the coach puts their lineup together, they can only have a maximum of 28 points on the field at one time. A quadriplegic is going to play in that lower 0 to 1 maybe classification. A amputee could be up in the 4-5.
Jeff says the sport is growing in popularity with new players joining every year.
There is no residency rule, which means you can pick up a player, you can fly somebody in. This weekend, we had 4 people come over from the Netherlands as free agents, just saying, hey, who can I play with?
Jason Miller has been playing wheelchair softball for 23 years.
A buddy of mine was like, hey, you need to come out and try softball. I got hooked immediately. I was like, this might be the coolest thing I've ever done in my life.
In 2024, Jason and his team beat out the competition and took home the World Series title.
The team I'm on right now, we're called the Courage Rolling Twins. This is our 11th year together. We won it last year.
Jason says winning is great, but for him, it's not the most important thing about the sport.
I love the guys I play with. I love the guys who coach us. It's just my second family, and it's dope as hell.
You can learn more at wheelchairsoftball.org. For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Court of Appeals has overturned the felony conviction of an Enbridge Line 3 protester, citing misconduct by the prosecutor. That's according to a report from Amper's member station KAXE. In 2023, a jury convicted the protester of obstruction of justice. She attached herself to a bamboo structure during a protest at Enbridge's Swatara pumping station in central Minnesota back in 2021. The accused was sentenced to 1 year of unsupervised probation. But recently, the appeals court ruled she did not get a fair trial, pointing to at least five instances of serious misconduct by the Aiken County prosecutor at the time. The case now heads back to the district court for a new trial.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. When does a car reach the end of its life? And what happens to all the metal and plastic and hazardous fluids? NPR's Camila Domonoske was pondering those questions as her beloved old minivan started to fail, and she brings us this story.
The Chrysler Town & Country that's more or less permanently in our driveway was passed on to us from my in-laws. Vanny is 20 years old, with 183,000 miles on it, and these days we barely use it. We put more miles on our e-bike than the van last year. And it's bad for a vehicle not to be driven, in more ways than one.
There's wasps. It has wasps. Yeah. Oh, regrets.
My three-year-old brought the news inside to my husband. In addition to the wasps, again, Vanny also isn't starting. Again. My kids adore this old van, but I do not want to pay to fix it again. So we have to decide if we'll sell it, donate it, or recycle it to see if it can help our community or at least not hurt the planet. First question, is it still useful? I swung by to chat with Keith Knupp. He's the Keith of Keith's Auto Sales here in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Would you like to buy my minivan?
I would not like to buy your minivan.
The wasps in the van didn't faze him, but the 180,000 miles did. I tried to make the case to Knupp that this wasn't just any old van. This was Vanny.
This van, when my husband and I were 18 years old, we drove across the country in this van, and it like carried all of our hopes and dreams to Arizona.
It was good then. I hope you're not going to Arizona in that van again.
Another option is to donate Vanny to a charity that would auction it off, like the ASPCA or our local public radio station. Or give it to a nonprofit like Way to Go, a local group which fixes up cars for people who can't afford them. Executive Director Ashley Gordon Becker said she would love to take a look at Vanny.
For a family that has no means of transportation, a vehicle that's 20 years old, it doesn't matter as long as it's safe and reliable.
But if it's not reliable, then Vanny has another destiny. That's the sound of a Nissan Rogue being crushed at M&M Auto Parts in Fredericksburg, Virginia, where Jonathan Morrow works.
I'm actually a third-generation automotive recycler.
Undrivable cars wind up here, but Morrow's salvage yard is also part of a new program called Shift, which encourages owners to donate cars to be recycled, with the goal of getting high-polluting old cars off the road and keeping useful stuff out of landfills. Before a vehicle gets crushed, it's broken down into all of its parts. Transmissions sold off, fluids reused, metals melted down. Morrow argues that's the best use of our van.
I think your minivan still has parts that somebody could use.
And cars donated to Shift get sent to environmentally certified salvage yards, and they don't get sold overseas, which can happen at an auction. Morrow gave me a tour of the yard.
All the fluids are pneumatically taken outside, but you can see that the diesel, the gas, those two brown are oil, and you've got washer fluid, antifreeze.
Those fluids are reused. Gas in vehicles, oil burned to heat the buildings, antifreeze cleaned and resold. Then, inside a big room that looks like an auto shop where cars would get fixed, they get dismantled instead.
It's the engine, the transmission, this is the AC compressor tag, transfer case.
Cars donated through Shift will not have their engines reused, so they won't pollute anymore, but everything else could get a second life, sometimes after a little TLC. We walk past James Catlett as he's tapping on a Mini Cooper's hood, doing paintless dent repair.
It's almost just like massaging metal.
Bits get stripped off for possible reuse, one by one, and eventually what's left goes into that crusher. All the metal left there will get recycled too.
When we do this, it's keeping all of these things out of the landfill, right? Because that's the end goal.
A layer of car seats gets thrown in, and another car goes on top for a very crunchy sandwich. The metal mods seem like the very end of a vehicle's life, but it's not exactly. The black Nissan Rogue I'm watching get crushed, bits of it will live on, shipped off to a body shop to keep another Rogue rolling. And even this mangled metal will be shredded and melted and then rebuilt into rebar, a toaster, maybe another car. My kids like to pretend that our 20-year-old van is a transformer, that it can become a robot. It's just imagining. But someday, maybe Vanny really will turn into something else. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
A K-pop hit tops this week's Billboard Albums chart, but it's not the song you might expect. NPR Music's Stephen Thompson has the report.
It's another big week for K-pop music on the Billboard charts, and another big week for the K-pop Demon Hunters soundtrack, which again lands four songs in the top 10. And yes, the song Golden by the fictional girl group Huntrix still sits at number one. We won't play it again here because, well, you've probably heard it before. But on the albums chart, K-pop Demon Hunters has to settle for second place, because yet another K-pop juggernaut debuts in the top spot. That'd be the boy band Stray Kids, whose new album is titled Karma. Listen to the world cry. Karma, 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 karma. It pips. Hey! It pips. Hey! It pips. It pips. Karma, 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 karma. The success of Karma is tied almost entirely to album sales. The group sold nearly 300,000 copies, which is remarkable in the age of streaming. It's the second biggest sales week for any album released this year, after The Weeknd's Hurry Up Tomorrow. The problem with sales, where the charts are concerned, is that they don't carry over from week to week. For sustained chart success, albums need a huge audience on streaming. And on the Billboard streaming charts, Karma is at number 34. Without massive streaming numbers, just one Stray Kids song cracks this week's Hot 100, Ceremony, at number 52. Still, Stray Kids have done something no artist has ever done before. Of the seven albums and EPs they've landed on the Billboard Albums chart, all seven have debuted at number one. With the success of Karma, Stray Kids have also racked up the most number one albums by any artist this century, surpassing BTS, Linkin Park, and Dave Matthews' Band in the process. That's a big deal given that those seven chart toppers came out in the span of just 3.5 years. But don't get used to Karma sitting at number one. All six of Stray Kids' previous hits topped the chart for just 1 week. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
You're rocking out to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at MoveItRealEstate.com. Across the Arts Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for the group exhibit, Expressing Grief, Friday, September 5th from 4 to 7 p.m. Five regional artists come together to honor the experience of grief in its many forms. Weather tonight, showers likely, cloudy with temps in the low 40s, northwest winds gusting up to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 50s, breezy northwest winds, evening temps in the low 40s. Now back to All Things Considered.